This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Good morning. It's a good morning, and I really appreciated again the introduction to the topic of the day. You see, I was coming before you this morning concerned that maybe I'm going to push too hard and make you feel like you have to carry a load that isn't yours to carry. And I really appreciated the emphasis that we don't have to carry the load. We don't have to carry the worries. We just do what we can. We fit in to what God has planned for us. And I would just like to assure you that God will never ask you to do something that He doesn't supply the strength and the grace to do. So you can bank on that one. You can put it in your pocket. I wore my cargo pants this morning because I like cargo pants, because I can carry more things. It was a couple years ago that I realized that they're perfect for traveling, because you can stick passports in one side and your airline tickets in the other, and especially, you know, if you have three passports to deal with, it's good to have lots of pockets. And so I'd encourage you all to sort of get a pair of cargo pants, spiritually, or sort of in your teaching. Be willing to carry some things that maybe generally we don't think of being a teacher's responsibility. We're looking at connecting with a variety of families. So you see the child that you teach. Maybe you have 8 students, or 20 students, or 25 students. How well do you know quiet little Susie in the back? How well do you know the ones that don't cause trouble? They kind of get average to good grades, and they come in and out of your classroom. Do you know their family? Do you know where they come from? Do you know what their struggles are? Do you know what their interests are? How well do you know them? And I am not a fine example of knowing people. I have trouble remembering people, and I love to talk to them, and I love to work with people. But sometimes it seems like my life is so full of little people at our school, and my day is so full of things to do, it's hard to take those moments to make that difference. So I'd like to start by looking at what an ideal family looks like. What does an ideal family look like? And I'd like to take some suggestions from you all. What's that family like that you really like having at school? Maybe you can think back to the community where you teach. I thought of some things, and I just encourage you to jot down what's useful to you. You don't have to write what I say. Make these notes personal. I think God's intent since the beginning was for a mom and a dad to love each other and to commit to each other for the rest of their lives and raise their children to fear God and to love God. That was the plan. And so an ideal family will have a mom and a dad that love each other. I really appreciated the comment about the best things in life are free, and so we take them for granted. How many of you can raise your hand, have a mom and a dad that love God? How many of you have that? See, that's just amazing. I would love for you to be able to go into a public school in any city here in the U.S. and ask that same question and look for that same raise of hands. And I would say that's one of your greatest advantages as a Christian teacher. Because you see, I have a mom and a dad that love God too. And that has been such a blessing. And it fills my life with so many good things, because mom and dad love each other and they love God. So don't take that one for granted. We're going to be doing an assignment here at the end of the talk today, if we get there. But here's one for you already if we don't. Call your mom and dad today if you can, or send them a text or an email and just say, Mom and Dad, thank you for loving each other and for loving God and for teaching me about love. An ideal family, their parents would be Christians. They'd be born again. Have any other things come to your mind? What does an ideal family look like? Is this an ideal family? Maybe that's an ideal family. Again? A man who takes the lead. Thank you. Very good point. And a wife that works with him.
Love their children.
They should love their children. And over here? Yes. Good. A family that works through their difficulties. See, family life isn't easy. I would say raising a family today is not easy. Anything else? I thought of a knowledge of God, an understanding, and an obedience to the Bible. That was already mentioned. A father who takes the lead, a mother who supports him. People that can use the Word of God to understand solutions to their problems. That's an ideal family. An ideal family is involved in a Bible-believing and practicing church. They take their children to church. And again, most of us went to church as children. You have no idea how much that impacted your life. An ideal family is supportive of the school, right? Yeah. They might not always agree with the teacher, but they never tell the children that. If they've got a problem with the teacher, they'll be calling you. And remember that. If a parent ever calls you and says, you know, I have some questions. I have some doubts about what you're doing in the classroom. My first instinct is to become very defensive and say, wait a minute, I'm the teacher. But you know how much courage it took for that mom or that dad to pick up the phone? They know you're the teacher. But they have some concerns. Listen to them. An ideal family is desirous of a Christian education for their children. One of the most important things to them is their children and where their children are going to end up. An ideal family has disciplined home routines. I love when the children come to school and they're already disciplined. They know how to sit and they know how to obey. And you talk to them, you tell them something, and they don't forget it right away. They do it. They're stable, emotionally stable. They model and they practice biblical principles at home. Now, I was going to remember to do this right at the start, and I forgot. So you're going to have to think really fast. Think about some ideal families or exemplary families in the Bible. Can you think of some? I was shocked last night when I tried to think of some good, solid, ideal families in the Bible. They're strangely missing. I thought of Joseph. No. What about Jacob? No. No, that wasn't ideal. The only ones that I could really come up with was Joseph and Mary, Jesus' parents. That was kind of weird. We thought about Timothy. Mom and grandma were great Christian ladies, and his dad was a Greek. I don't know what that has to do with it, other than he was a Greek. Are there any others? Aquila and Priscilla, you know, they probably were a really good family. I would have loved to have been able to get to know them. Thank you. And I thought of Noah. He was under a lot of stress and pressure, but he got his sons and their wives into the ark. I always wondered where their children were. I think there's a lot more in the Bible than we read. So we have a variety of families that you work with. And once again, I don't know your situation, and so I hope I'm not wasting your time here this morning. But I listed a variety of families, and I would ask the question, what is normal? What is a normal family? So we've talked about an ideal family. What's a normal family look like? You know, maybe we're not all ideal. Maybe we're just normal. That's what our family looked like about 5 or 7 years ago. You see, we got involved with in the lives of some of the students in our school. And as their lives fell apart, it seemed like they were led to us. Those are my 6 Guatemalan boys. I still have contact with all of them, kind of. And they all took a lot of work, and they all come from very dysfunctional, not normal or ideal families. But I have to be careful how I use the word normal. I was talking to a good friend last night, and he was telling me about some Bible club that they have in one of the cities not far from here. And what's normal down there in Guatemala sounds pretty normal over here in Meadville. So we didn't have a real normal Mennonite family. This is what it looks like a little later. You can't see the pictures real well. But that was our family. That's our family. This is the variety of families that we work with, and you just write down whatever suits you, whatever is important to you in your teaching. Some of the children in your class may come from a single parent family, and that's not always bad. Sometimes to have a single parent family is better than an abusive situation, I believe. Dysfunctional, we throw that word around, at least I do. What's dysfunctional? Apply that word dysfunctional to the families that you see listed and illustrated in the Bible. A bunch of them were pretty dysfunctional too. I thought about Joseph. You talk about dysfunctional. Divorced. When there's a divorce, that causes no end of trouble in a child. And I thought about a head-on collision. When you have a car, you buy a car. You even pick the color you wanted. And then a couple months later, you roll it, or you run into the garage door. You know, that car will never be the same again. They can paint it. They can fix it. What if it's been in a head-on collision? And that sort of describes the emotional mess that I think children are in when their parents are separated or when they've gone through a divorce. Do any of you have abusive families that you work with? I would venture a guess that you do, and you may not even know it. You've got those permissive families. You've got those really strict families. You know, their dad's name is John Wayne. Got those wealthy families, and that's an advantage. You know, they have a lot of things. They can bring a lot of things into the school. It can also cause problems, too. You have those really, really poor families, and that's a disadvantage. And sometimes it's an advantage. You have the mom in charge families. A friend was telling me about his church, and this is meant to be funny. He was telling me about his church, and they decided to have heads of home meetings. but there were too many sisters showing up, so they changed them to men's meetings. You know, mom's in charge. We know who the head of the home is. There's the next one. Dad in charge. And that's how it's supposed to work. You have those overprotective families. And you know, those are the ones that always run out in front of the swings. They get nailed in the head. Oh, no. You know, he probably took his vitamins that morning, but he still walked out in front of the swing. Or sat under the teeter-totter. Why do they do that? You have those work-oriented families where they work together, and maybe the children work and work and work. And maybe that's why they don't get their homework done. And maybe it's not that you're so boring. They're just plain tired. That's why they fell asleep in class. How many of you have had a student fall asleep on you in class? Isn't that fun? We have a lot of families where the person in charge, the head of the home, the caregiver, and the mother and father is actually the grandma, just because of how our culture is structured. And then you have those arrogant families, and you could add to your list as you think about the community where you work. Who is responsible for the children? I think of these two boys. The first guy here wearing the cake, that's actually a hat. You see, to liven up things, sometimes to motivate creativity in our school, we have what we call days that are un poco loco, a little bit crazy. So we have Hat Day, that's a picture from Hat Day. And we have come as you would, dressed as what you would like to be when you get big. So we have little soccer players running around and some doctors and some firemen and other things. Well, this little guy wearing the hat, his father was killed one day on his way home from work. He was involved in some things, probably drug trafficking, and he was killed. And who's responsible now for him? Well, his mom. But he still needs a dad. This guy over here, they say his dad was responsible for the first guy's death. And he's been killed too. Now, who's going to take on those boys? Who's going to work with them? They're both obnoxious. They're both hard to work with. This second little guy, boy, he had a trip to my office every week. I got to know him. We talked about that yesterday. Who can help? You see, they come with a truckload of baggage. They're not sure who they are. They're not sure where they want to go. How involved should we get? Remember this little face because I might tell you about him later on. So I have seven ways that I found in the Bible that we're encouraged to help as teachers. And I use some King James Version and I use some ESV. Is that English Standard Version? Just because then we got to use the word teach. And so it applies it a little bit more to teachers. And I'm going to let you guess, or at least we're going to read the verse and see if you can think of the way that we could help. They all start with B. Titus 2, 7 and 8 says, show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. And in your teaching, show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. We should be
a model
or a good example.
Be a good example in what you do. Take action. Someone told me, and it's never left me, it was a member of our school board, as I was going in to teach in a fairly difficult situation, a difficult classroom, he said, you know, sometimes it's better to do the wrong thing right away than to do nothing at all. Many times, he went on to explain, that we have this situation in class and we don't know what to do. He said it's better to do something, even though thinking back later, maybe you could have done something that would have been a little bit better or you could have changed it, but he said that's better than leaving it and trying to think of all the angles and then ending up doing nothing at all. And so take action, be a good example, and your action, again, your example, speaks so much into their lives. James 3, 1 and 2 says, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and my sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For we all stumble in many ways, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, also able to bridle or discipline, have in subjection, his whole body. 1 Corinthians 15, 58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, forasmuch as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. I would encourage you to be faithful. Be faithful. How many of you had a teacher that you saw one time and what they were wearing or what they were doing or what they were saying surprised you and disappointed you? Did that ever happen? Because it happened to me, and I know how it affected me. What if you would just lose out? Say here in a couple years you decide, forget it. I'm not only going to quit teaching, I'm going to just go and do a whole different thing. I'm going to leave my church and I'm just going to go do what I feel like. As a teacher, I don't think you can do that. So be faithful. That's one of the greatest things that you can do. You don't have to be a superhero. You don't have to do what I do. And I should clarify, just because I talk about the work, I don't want to leave the impression that I think that all of you should do what I do. I tell people this way, Abraham left Ur, right? And his obedience was counted for righteousness. But I don't think we're all called to leave Ur. Abraham was, and it's good he did. Noah was told by God to build an ark, but we're not all building arks. But whatever God tells you to do, do it with all your might. If God says get involved with that family, then by all means get involved. And you may get to the threshold or the doorway of involvement and say, that looks messy. You know, it probably is. But that's okay. Get involved. You might even say, in some of your situations, that looks dangerous. It probably is. But that's okay. God has promised to be with you. Luke 6:40 says, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Here we have it. Be a model. Be a mentor. I failed to include the second reference in case you want to jot that down. You probably know where it is anyway. I heard a story, and I'll try to repeat it as best I remember it. I looked for it online, and I couldn't find it. But there's a story of a chaplain that went to jail and talked to the men. And he knew personally a pro football player that was a Christian. And so one day he made the arrangements for him to go with him to the jail and talk to the prisoners. And they went, and the chaplain was introducing this man, and well, a lot of the prisoners knew him. They had seen him play. He said, he's going to talk to us today. And he's going to tell us, he's going to speak to us from the Word of God. And then the chaplain was doing something else, and he said, you know, we all have needs, and we all are kind of messed up. He said, how many of you, when you were little guys, your dad said to you once or several times, you know, someday you're going to end up in prison? And 75% of them raised their hands. And then he turned to the pro football player for him to talk, and he was crying. Big old tears running down his face. He explained, he said, I can't believe what I just saw. Those dads told their boys, you know, you're going to end up in prison. Because ever since I was little, my dad always said, you're going to be a pro football player someday. You can do it. I know you can. Those are just words. But our words carry a lot of weight when we put some action behind them, when we give example. I think we'll skip that one. Well, I could tell you, I guess, about Carlos. These are three boys that I see a couple times a week. Well, they're at school every day. These two guys over here, you can't see them terribly well, both have lost their fathers in the last 2 years. First little guy, his dad was a thief, and they shot him. And the second little guy, his dad was a baker and a hard worker, and they shot him, and I don't know why. But they're both running around without dads. And they need somebody to pick up where they left off, where their lives were blown apart. The little guy here, licking out the bowl of yogurt, he's from one of the maybe five functional families that my wife and I could think of in our town last night. We were talking about it. He gets to be in a good family. The guy behind him is little Carlos. His dad was named Carlos too. And he was involved in probably drug trafficking, things he shouldn't have been. One day they came by the house and they shot him. And they got him to the hospital. And they did some emergency surgery in one of the best hospitals in our region, and they got him stable. And we were all thankful because Carlos, big Carlos, had another chance. 2 days later, two men walked into his hospital room and finished him off in the hospital bed. That's Carlos. He's in grade 5. When you ask him what he wants to be when he grows up, he says, I want to find the men that killed my father. And so someone is going to have to come in and change some ideas. He comes to Sunday school once in a while. He'd come every Sunday if I'd pick him up. Sometimes I just run out of time. He lives with his mom. He and mom live together. She kind of got messed up after her husband's death, and she wasn't sure what to do. It's really hard for a single lady to live and function and succeed or survive in our community, in our culture. So she moved in with her uncle. Actually, her uncle moved in with her. And Carlos lives there too. What sort of comfort do we have to offer that? Matthew 20, 26 and 28 come right after a big fight that Jesus' disciples had It's Jesus' response to the argument that came out of the two sons of Zebedee's mother asking for them to have a special place in the kingdom. And then Jesus says that in the world, the great exercise authority. And then he says, but it shall not be so among you. Whoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief or top dog among you, let him be your servant. Even so, even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. We should be a servant. Now, we've got a bit of problems with the outline here. 1 Peter 4:10, you could just draw an arrow down two lines below with Romans 12:7, and the right reference is Matthew 20, 26 and 28 to 28. They say that we shouldn't do anything for our students that they can do for themselves. And I agree. I'm all for that. But we can find so many ways to serve. And we should serve. We're called to serve. We already heard this morning that we should be gentle. And I believe that we should be gentle. There's a little phrase that I read every once in a while in a certain publication that says gently but firmly. And I heard it yesterday and it just made me laugh out loud. But there's a lot of truth in it. We should be gentle but firm. So, gently but firmly. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass and like showers upon the herb. May your teaching and may your discipline and may all that you do come like a gentle dew on the life of the children that you work with. 1 Peter 4:10, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Romans 12:7, if service in our serving, the one who teaches in his teaching. We should be willing to use our gifts. We have the parable of the talents in Matthew 25:14-30. And we all know the parable of the talent. The one was given five, the one was given two, and the one was given one talent. And they were to use their talents and they were to multiply them. The one that had one talent didn't. He was scared. And so he hid it in the ground. And I wonder how many times I'm scared and I hide it in the ground. Because I couldn't do that. If you've been given gifts, use them to the Lord. Use them for the Lord. Right after the story, the parable of the talents, we have another passage in Scripture, which to me is incredible, and doubly so because it follows the parable of the talents. It's about the judgment when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all his angels with him. Then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be assembled before him. That means you and I will be there. We'll be there. And he will separate people, one from another, like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. It's just that obvious. Like a shepherd that would have to divide the sheep from the goats. God's going to know which one goes where. And then he starts talking and he says, you know, you saw me naked, you saw me needy, you saw me thirsty, and you supplied my need. Enter into the joy of your Lord, of the Lord. And what just thrills me, it never fails to run shivers up my spine. when the just say, when? We don't remember. It's there. That's what they say. And he says, inasmuch as you did it unto the least of these, you did it unto me. And then he talks to the other ones, and he says, you didn't. You didn't help me. And they say the same thing. When? When did we see you? Come on. It almost seems like, give us a chance. When did we see you? He said, inasmuch as you didn't do it to the least of these, you didn't do it to me. To me, that's amazing. We should use our gifts. We should be willing to use our gifts. Be biblical. 2 Timothy 2:15 in the other version says, do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker who has no need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. And Matthew 5:19, therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. What's our goal? I'd like to read you some verses from Ephesians. And I use the New English Translation Bible because it goes so well with the Spanish Bible that I preach out of. And so I'll read these verses and you just listen to them. Ephesians 4:1-7 says, I therefore, the prisoner for the Lord, urge you to live worthily of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to keep unity in the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you too were called to one hope of your calling. There's one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. That to me is absolutely amazing. Do we need to worry? Do we need to fret? No. He's in it all, through all and over all. But to each one of us, grace was given. Get this, grace was given according to the measure of the gift of Christ. If you use your gifts, what will you get? Grace. You'll be given all the grace you need for today, for what you've been asked to do. The goal, then, is here in Ephesians 4:11-16. We talked about the body. We talked about the fact that we're team players and we're members of the body and we've been given different abilities and different gifts. And look what we're supposed to do with them. To me, this is really key. This is kind of bringing it all together. He gave apostles and prophets and evangelists and shepherds, pastors, and teachers. And this is what he wants us to do. We should all work together to three things: perfect the saints, prepare them to minister, and edify the body of Christ. Now that gives me a new perspective for teaching. And that gives me a new perspective for dealing with the families that are represented in my classroom. Because I'm supposed to prepare them to minister to the body. We should get them part of the body. And we should do that over and over and over again. Let me just throw this in for what it's worth. Some of you may admire what I do. It's actually kind of whatever some days. What I admire is the teacher that can go to the same little school and teach the same 10 or 12 students year after year after year after year where nothing really happens. And where everybody's kind of, you know, set in their mold. That's what I admire, just in case you wondered. We should do that over and over, teachers, until everyone attains the unity of faith, the knowledge of the Son of God. They turn into the perfect kind of person. The Bible actually says that. I read it several times to make sure. And if it doesn't say that to you, I'd be interested in knowing what it says. Because that's as close as I could come. We're supposed to help these children become the best they can be. The most perfect kind of person, because they're built to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And they get to see it in their teacher. They get to see that example day after day after day, even if they can't find it at home. They get to see it in their teacher. We should always speak the truth in love. Is there a difference between speaking the truth and speaking the truth in love? I have issues with a verse in Proverbs that says love, is it Proverbs? Love hides a multitude of sin. What does that mean? And how does that affect speaking the truth in love? I know how I take it. Grow into Christ, the head, in all things. In all of the areas. Now we should never, those same verses, Ephesians 4, 11 to 16, say that we should never be wishy-washy. We should never be blown around by false doctrines. We should never be affected by human cunning and the latest and the greatest in humanistic philosophy. We should not be swayed. We have the Bible, and we have Christ, our head. And so we should never be deceived. We shouldn't be swayed by human reasoning or craftiness. We should never be trapped by deception. I missed going over a sheet that you have in your binders. It's the really small print one with a bunch of ideas and tips for teaching. I'd like to just let you know what I have planned for that, and I'll let the brother here, Joshua, decide how he's going to do it. I'd like you to go through that list and read it. I'd like you to put a check by the points that you agree with or think they're a good idea. Say, yeah, I can agree with that. I'd like you to underline 5 of the tips or ideas that you already practice. And I'd like you to circle 5 ideas or tips that you would like to implement or you'd like to make yours part of your practice in this coming school year. And then I'd like you to, in groups of 3, share the ideas that you would like to work on with the other 2 people in your group. Now, my suggestion, you can do it however you like. I'd say do it when you have a spare moment. You're all teachers, so you know about assignments and homework. Take it up over lunch, I don't care. You don't have to do it right now, but that's up to you. God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.